don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Jay, he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
Listen, I know I say this every year, but I feel like this season of Second Captain Saturday has been the most fun yet. We had our USA 94 themed chats with Joseph O'Connor and Brian F. O'Byrne. A trip to the Auras for crying out loud. There's also the Siobhan McSweeney episode. And by the way, what a brilliant job she's doing on The Traitors. She's absolutely nailing it. No spoilers, please, Murph.
Don't say a word.
Grant, I'm one episode behind. It sounds like you are as well. Yeah, so no spoilers.
I'm trailing here.
All of it comes to a thrilling end today in the final show of the season as we crown our greatest non-sportsperson for 2025. The last guest who can make a run for the title is Ankur Vikal. Ankur is a hugely accomplished movie and theatre actor in India. He's appeared in more than 20 films over the years, including a leading role in one of the biggest international movies of the century, Slumdog Millionaire. He's also starred, I know, if you know that movie.
Yeah.
Everyone knows it. He's also starred in groundbreaking Indian films like Mango Souffle, which was seen as Indian cinema's first serious treatment of gay relationships. He's acted in around 40 plays, often taking on roles that explore more difficult areas of Indian society. Recently, he starred in the Emmy-nominated Amazon Prime series Inside Edge. And best of all, Ankur lives in Dublin and is in with us today in studio. Just going back to Slumdog Millionaire there, Murph.
Yeah.
Directed by Danny Boyle, set in Mumbai, released in 2008, I think it was.
Yeah.
And it really was a sensation.
Oh, I mean, it earned $380 million at the box office on a $15 million budget.
That's a decent profit in anyone's language.
Yeah, but it was also hugely critically acclaimed. Yeah. So Ankur's role is pivotal in the movie. He generates much of the film's darkness. He plays Maman, a gangster who takes in orphans and exploits them, forcing them onto the streets to beg for money. So he and the Slumdog cast won a Screen Actors Guild, the SAG Award, for Best Ensemble, a big, big honour in the run-up to the Oscars. The last two films to win it were Conclave and Oppenheimer. It then went on to win 8 Oscars, 7 BAFTAs, both of which included Best Picture and Best Director. And it was a big hit in India as well, particularly after the Oscars, which many people felt was kind of down to a fascination with how India is seen by the West, which is an interesting idea that we've wrestled with regarding successful Irish movies in the recent past as well. So it remains just a huge cultural
phenomenon. Yeah, the Oscars was a massive thing. Weren't they all up on stage? There's an image of a huge crowd of people who've been involved in the movie up there. Such a joyous occasion.
Yeah.
Can't wait to talk to them about that today. We also thought this would be a particularly good time to chat to Ankur, given everything the Indian community in Ireland has been going through in recent times. We all heard about the man who was savagely beaten and stripped by a group of teenagers in Tala in July. Another man left with a fractured cheekbone after being beaten in Clondalkin. A nurse in Lucan who had a glass bottle thrown at her while she was out training for the mini marathon. The 6-year-old girl in Waterford attacked by young boys and told to go back to India.
Yeah.
But these are just some of the more high profile incidents that have been reported. We've had the Indian Embassy in Ireland release a statement saying all Indian citizens in Ireland are advised to take reasonable precautions for their personal security and avoid deserted areas. President Michael D. Higgins spoke out saying the recent despicable attacks on members of the Indian community stand in stark contradiction to the values that we as a people hold dear. Such acts diminish all of us and obscure the immeasurable benefits the people of India have brought to the life of this country. It's important to mention also that huge crowds have gathered, for example, in Tala after the attack I mentioned earlier, for an anti-racism protest, just to emphasise that this sort of attack doesn't represent these places or the people who live there. So, listen, we'll talk to Ankur about how he came to live in Dublin and his experiences here, both good and bad. And Murphy's our final contestant in the greatest non-sportsperson competition. Remind us of the greatest season yet and what Ankur has to do to nip in and win this title.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
So now the end is near. It's time on to face the final curtain. It has been a thrilling race to find our greatest non-sportsperson of 2025. You know the drill by now. Our guest comes on. I assess their sporting talents, pick a sportsperson that I believe best sums up their abilities, and then after hearing their all-time sporting highlight, I give them points out of 100. That's what we do here. There was a time when Brian F. O'Byrne looked to shoe in for his pitch-invading travails at USA 94 and his teenage midfield partnership with Meath football legend PJ Gaelic.
Oh, yeah.
Just for Connor and Spider Stacy's charge for glory blew up on the launch pad. Siobhan McSweeney's traitor's heroics came too late to impact the scoring. In any other year, let's face it, Alvy Carraher's two national running titles would have been good enough to secure a final victory.
Alvy's unfortunate not to be top dog here.
Self-esteem's teenage cricketing prowess, impressive last week.
Yep.
But not impressive enough to challenge our current leader in more ways than one, President Michael D. Higgins, who sits atop the leaderboard on 90 points with one guest left to go. Anchor Vikal will take his chances inside the next hour.
I know you didn't actually mention President Higgins' sporting abilities there. I mean, he literally lists out all the sporting achievements of all our other guests and then said, the president is obviously number one here.
He's got 90 points. And let's just say the fact that he's the president may have contributed a few points.
Our final guest of the current series of Second Captain Saturday is Slumdog Millionaire star Ankur Vikal, who has had a prolific career in theatre and cinema, appearing in dozens of films, including the international sensation Slumdog Millionaire. He's been living in Dublin for a number of years now, and I'm thrilled to say he's in studio with us today. Ankur, welcome.
Thank you so much.
This connection with Ireland actually goes a long way back to your childhood. Is this right? You were taught by Irish priests in India?
That's correct, yeah. We had Jesuit priests teaching us in St. Xavier's when I was growing up.
What sort of stuff were they teaching you?
Conscience and honesty.
All the big stuff.
Critical, diseases.
Morals instruction and stuff like that.
Were they exposing you to Irish literature and music and those sorts of things?
Yeah, we did have exposure to lovely writers. And I was fascinated by Beckett. Oscar Wilde, I was very drawn to.
Were you into the arts then at a young age? Did you see yourself, was it always the dream to be a big famous actor?
Not really. It was way much later in college. I was studying architecture. During architecture, I was dragged by a senior of mine. She was in the fifth year and she brought me to a theater company called The Playhouse. And I went there and I was really embarrassed because there's all these cool people sitting back and laughing really loudly and speaking very comfortably and stuff. And I was terrified and they wanted me to sing for an audition for a Philip King play called I'll Get My Man. And I left. I was too terrified by all these cool people and I ran away. And so this senior of mine, Anjali, she caught me drinking chai on a stall because that's what we do in India. Everyone's drinking chai, these tiny cups of tea on the street. She brought me back. She insisted I go back. And then I guess once I went back, I started feeling very comfortable being around all these lovely people. And
why do you think your initial reaction was to be terrified of those people who you thought were so cool?
They were very comfortable in their skins and I may not have been. I still am not, I think. I'm not the most comfortable person socially, I think. But acting did help me along the way.
Because it's kind of, it's like a contradiction in a lot of ways. You know, that maybe a lot of actors feel that way, that socially they can be a little awkward. But acting seems to be, you can be someone else entirely and there's a comfort maybe in that.
Sure, and you get words to speak, All you have to do is learn them up and then you have these conversations that you can have with people. I don't know.
Where were you at in your career, Ankur, when Slumdog Millionaire came along? What had you been doing up to that point?
So I was a part of a theatre company called Motley in Bombay. The discipline of working on things was born from theater. I trained at the National School of Drama in Delhi. It is a tough place to get into. They take 20 people and then you're a national scholar and they pay you to study there. So it's pretty deadly and tough to get in. You can imagine there's 1.5 billion of us.
Yeah, there's so probably 20. A few prospective actors in there.
So it's a privilege being in that school. And so I was doing a bunch of plays and working on films. I was fortunate enough to get work in a lot of films before Slumdog as well in Bombay. Yeah, so post-architecture, I went to the drama school and then I came to Bombay.
Yeah. In the middle of it, did you feel like this was going to be a worldwide hit and it was going to be winning Oscars to the extent that it did 8 Oscars?
Not at all. But in hindsight, now after 25 years of being in the job, I realized that the people who seem to make good art or work are just children playing, and the urge to play, not to take oneself too seriously, is what I find common in every lovely person that I have learned from. And I'm talking about Danny Boyle, and I'm talking about Anthony Dodd Mantle.
So, actually, it's the spirit of a child.
You're right.
In the
childlikeness in
yes,
the arts
yeah.
is what I find pretty intriguing. The ability that, you know, everyone's playing. You know, you don't take yourself too seriously.
Was it important? Did it feel important to you at the time when the success started coming in that movie, that this is a film based in India with a largely Indian cast, that it could achieve that level of international success? Was that a big deal to you and to the other actors? Was that what you set out to do with it?
You can probably come up with these theories in hindsight, but while you are in the throes of a project, you don't really know what's up. You just show up. My teacher used to say that, he still says it, that, you know, everything spontaneous is extremely rehearsed. Mm. And I kind of really appreciate the paradox of that statement, that, you know, you just work hard enough and then it becomes second nature, whether it's cooking or when I watch Sirsha walking or doing things, it's the same thing, you know, the ability to get up and try again and keep doing that.
Was it life-changing for you?
Not really. It was just another job, and I still look at it like that. I was too awkward to go to the academies, and I got my SAG award in the post. I was stupid in hindsight. Maybe it would have helped, you know, go and schmooze and network a bit more.
Yeah.
It would have helped get better gigs and maybe get an agent in the UK and the States and stuff. But like I said, there's like maybe two parts to the profession, and I'm still learning the other part, where meeting people and accessing good work is also that. It's not just doing the job well.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially now, given the state of social media and the internet and so on.
Yeah, and so much of the Oscars is about, you know, 6 months long campaigns for films and everything. Like, it is, there's an industry to it. There's like a certain dance routine that you have to go through. But like in your own personal kind of experience of it, watching the Oscars, did you sit down and watch them that
No.
You didn't?
No. I was asleep. Because they were telecast.
I was going to ask you.
Or in the morning, and you know, it's a different time zone
in
India.
Yeah,
so when I woke up, we'd already won.
Yeah.
And
But did you wake up that morning feeling, oh, I should have gone, or?
I don't know. I was just happy for everyone who was involved in the project. And there was a part of me that felt that, hey, I should have. Maybe, you know, because I pretty much soon after that, I saw people's careers change based on the amount of proactively they pursued the media at that point.
Mm.
So I, in hindsight, I do think I, you know, maybe coming from a career or a background where someone can guide you a bit. I don't know.
What about the other side of the equation then? Because you said there's two sides to it. There's that idea of getting yourself out there, the public-facing actor, but the work itself seems to be what you're more comfortable with.
Yep.
You play Maman in Slumdog, a horrible character, a gangster who exploits the young children when they're orphaned, puts them to work as beggars. What's the appeal of playing a role as dark as that?
I'm very drawn to characters who are misfits and living on the fringes of society, and to discover the humanity of really tortured and twisted people who, you know, are forgotten or are being pushed onto the sidelines or on the fringes of society. They all seem to have a point of view, you know. The antagonist is also a broken child. I mean, we are witnessing extremely twisted darkness in our times right now. I mean, it's a miracle that we all get up and we access optimism, but I mean, I'm very fascinated by what makes someone do what they do. And this crazy, delicate dance between victimhood and oppression, and how do you straddle the two and be neither? Because we all end up being one or the other at any given point. And our past seems to inform that narrative. You know, where someone feels like a victim and someone else chooses to be the oppressor because they were a victim at some point. And how do you not be either?
Because it's not just Slumdog we're talking about here. You do play some dark characters in
other work like Nirbhaya, the play, critically acclaimed play that you toured the world with. You said at one point that some other actors in India haven't really taken well to a lot of the work that I do. This is a few years back. You said this. The intention for most of the art created in India is escapism. We don't want to look our own shit in the eye. Is that something you still feel today?
Yeah, for sure. I think that since there are a few of us back home, the urge or the pressure to stand out is dictated by commerce, and one may not have the privilege of being truthful, because the urge to succeed is really strong in most of the people back home, because you're competing with a lot of people, you know. So I see where that comes from, but arts is supposed to be where we find our inspiration, and maybe that's the nature of the arts, that we are supposed to try and discover the truth of it, and eventually now it's just become a corporate mounted project, and the storytelling has fallen to the sidelines somewhere along the way.
Is there an issue there as well, where if you're trying to tell a nuanced story or a story with some difficult elements to it, you might not be seen to be representing India to the world in a way that a lot of people will be comfortable with, that you're digging up parts of a society that people maybe don't want you going near? Is that fair to say?
You're right. There may be a bit of that, because Danny, I was speaking in an interview that I read maybe a few weeks ago, and he said he would be appalled at making a Slumdog again, where he went to India with a few people, like the lead actor who grew up in London.
Yes.
And a couple of other people in the crew, and then hired a lot of people locally and told the story. He says that format wouldn't really work anymore. I think he probably realizes that the story could have been way more authentic if, he had taken everyone from India. But yeah. Also accents and stuff, like Dave does sound English.
Yeah.
And maybe that works, because Danny mentioned to me when we were filming it that the film wouldn't have been nominated for a best film, but rather a best foreign film, if the actors were speaking in Hindi and there were subtitles, like City of God, for instance. So a film needs to be in English so that people don't have to read the subtitles for it to be eligible for a best film, as opposed to a best foreign film. So the entire world is essentially competing for the best foreign film award, whereas to be a mainstream nomination, you need to have people speaking in English.
Yeah.
You're sitting here talking to us in the middle of Dublin City. How did you end up coming to live here in Ireland?
It was love. I fell in love with an Irish girl. She was the stage manager on Nirbhaya, and we were doing this long distance thing for 6 or 7 years, where I would come here for 6 months, blow the money that I earned on films, and then Trina would come to India and she would hang there. And then in the pandemic, I reckoned I should let love take precedence over work, and I was working in India all year at that point, but I flew here in 2020, in September 2020, on an empty airplane to be with her, and there's no regrets. I feel much happier for having done that.
That was an empty plane, obviously, because it was the middle of COVID. It was the early COVID times. I heard you had a great answer to the person at immigration who was asking you what you were doing here.
Yeah.
What was that?
Yeah. She said that, she asked me, why were you here? And I said,
reasons for travel or whatever.
Yeah. So I said, I was here for love. And she said that, the Republic of Ireland considers your reason for travel inessential.
And yes.
Because you can travel for business and you can travel for study. You can't be traveling for love. Mm. So I told her, I was sweating, I was wearing this mask and I was soaked in sweat and I was terrified that she's going to send me back. So I said that, maybe that's why we have the pandemic. Because you consider love is inessential and stuff. But I thought she was going to deport me and send me back home. But
you got through.
She said you can go eventually.
So you met Trina. She was working in Dublin when the play was on in Dublin. She was the stage manager or everywhere.
In India. We rehearsed
India. Okay.
And then we came to Edinburgh.
Because you did do it here as well, didn't you?
Yeah, we performed it at the Pavilion. We won a few awards and then the play traveled around the world for 3 years. So I got to hang with her for 3 years and see her work ethic before we started seeing each other.
Brilliant.
And yeah, she's
that's so nice. How did you find moving over here for after that? That commute actually sounds pretty tough going, if that's the right word for it, back and forth. That's a long distance relationship if ever there was one.
But I also feel that there are rules that, you know, we've been told are not conducive for a relationship. Maybe the carbon footprint and stuff might not be the coolest. But, you know, it is interesting having, we were working, then we got to hang together. But yeah, it wasn't the coolest arrangement until I came here, and now it feels like this is home. Like, you know,
how did you find moving here first? Were the people welcoming?
It was in the pandemic, and you know, one could only travel in a 5 kilometer radius, and so one would go for walks in the park and stuff, and so I didn't meet too many people, but it was great being around someone you love.
What has it been like professionally getting work here?
I came here and I wrote to Rough Magic. Rough Magic is this lovely theatre company, and they have this project called Rough Ideas. So I wrote a story for them, an idea for a story. I grew up in India, and being a part of Nirbhaya, where all these girls were speaking about things that went, you know, happened to them, made me access a lot of my own childhood and my memories from my childhood. I thought it was important to share these stories. I mean, I never really thought that I was clever enough to write. So I started writing a lot of stuff, and like I shared this idea with Rough Magic. They loved the idea and they helped me develop a play in Rough Ideas, which I performed in Dublin at the project. And I'm still developing that play. I got some funding from Arts Council. And if it is good enough, they would produce it.
It's great that you're writing that and trying to get that off the ground. In terms of acting, have there been challenges there? Like, would you be pigeonholed into being seen as an Indian character potentially in a play, as opposed to being seen as what you are, which is an extremely accomplished actor who can play lead roles? Is that something you have to deal with?
For sure. I guess I would have been hard-shouldered a bit. I have experienced that firsthand. But it's also led me to lovely things, like become a tutor at the National Screen Acting School here, and I teach at Gaiety School as well. So I think it's a mixed bag, you know. Mm. There's a lot of projects coming in here. Ireland's still opening up. It's not a London or UK or your LA. There seems to be a bit of a splinter in how Ireland is at the moment and how the writers are writing works of art in cinema, and especially theatre. Because if I go to the Abbey, I don't really see anyone who looks like me. And I think it is important for people like Sirsha, my daughter, who's growing up here, to see her, you know, dad or people like him in the arts, since we live here.
Writing your own stuff is one way to, I suppose,
right,
push that on a little bit, is it? Is
that's the intention.
Idea? Yeah. You've mentioned Sirsha a few times already, so you're laying down roots here, you've got a family. You did also say Dublin feels like home now.
Absolutely. I love the kindness, and it also really matters to me that ethically, I mean, people are at least able to protest on every Saturday. It's not like they're being hauled into prison if they're 80 and holding a banner, like in the UK or in Germany, or in India, where people are signing deals with the oppressor. So it's all a bit, I feel a little more, you know, ideologically happier when I'm in Dublin.
That's good. It's good to hear you're experiencing kindness as well, Anchor, because we all follow the news. We've all seen the stories of the horrific attacks of late on the Indian community in Ireland. Is it a scarier place to live now than when you first came here a few years ago?
I have a feeling that it's been happening all along.
Right.
And it's the social media that's maybe fanning it a bit. For instance, like all the Indians that I know here have experienced it. Everyone I speak with has been, you know, abused a bit racially. I have my own experiences. But I think it's a bit of upset against all immigrants or expats. There's no way to tell the difference. But there seems to be a bit of anger and resentment against everyone who's from the outside. And if I think about it, I think it may be the housing crisis in Ireland at the moment, and people feeling that they are being hard done by the locals. Maybe the problem is something like that. And then my friends say that, you know, the Brazilians were being picked on, but they probably retaliate. And then there's other people from war-torn countries who are probably fighting back. And Indians are probably too pacifists and non-violent. And
did you say, Anchor, everyone in the Indian community that you know has suffered something like this?
Yeah,
definitely. That's horrendous.
Yeah. A friend of mine, I was speaking with him yesterday, had this bottle of beer, empty bottle, hit on the car. He has a little son who was born in May. And he said, fortunately, the window was shut.
Oh, my word.
So, you know, it's tricky. And then the same night, there were eggs thrown on the door and stuff. And he installed a camera, got the footage of these lads. They're all youngsters, 11, 12. And there's one lad in the group who's maybe 16 or 17. And he has the footage and he sent it to the Garda. But apparently there's nothing that can be done with the juveniles or the youngsters. And
It must be so upsetting to be on the end of that, you know, for you, for your family. How do you navigate that? How do you deal with that?
I've been a bit confused about this, because, you know, I suppose all of us want to feel safe. And it is a bit concerning. I was pushed around a few days ago when I got off the bus. Someone, you know, physically pushed me. And I just kept smiling. And he said, why are you smiling? And maybe I always have this default smile on my face. And it was annoying to this Irish lad. And
this guy just comes up out of nowhere and starts pushing you around.
Yeah. So things like this are happening. And I think they're happening with all immigrants, not just the Indians, but because maybe someone in Tala spoke about the Indians being victimized, someone in Blanchardstown feels, hey, we need to do this too. So the youngsters there mobilize themselves and do it so that they don't get left behind. So maybe social media isn't really helping. It's in fact fueling it a bit, maybe. I don't know.
You said, Anchor, that you've had a few incidents. So you said.
Yeah.
And is it all roughly similar to what you told us there, getting pushed around?
Yeah. Someone took my phone once and I realized that they'd taken my phone. And so I said, hey, I can't let you take my phone. You need to return it. So they kind of hit me on the face. But then they threw the phone on the ground. So I picked it up and, you know, I left. I try not to pick a fight with anyone. Because I do know that these are just people who, like I said, if I'm playing all kinds of, you know, misunderstood people, I try to do my best to understand where these young lads are coming
from. You're being very empathetic, I must say. It must be quite hard in your position to try and show empathy and to understand where these people are coming from, because this is horrible stuff that's happening to you.
You're right, but I also just meet amazing people all the time.
Yeah.
So, like, getting this lovely teaching jobs here, being included in the communities and, you know, being able to do what I love, bits of it, like I've worked on a few series this year, and I'm hoping it all just leads to more work. And I'm hoping that the government, like, you know, looks at the housing crisis here, because I was reading something and it said that maybe 3 out of 5 Irish
young people,
yeah, I think under 25,
are
contemplating leaving the country because of this issue, and then housing issues. And the people coming in are, like, the Indians are coming in here to work in the IT and healthcare and stuff, but there's not enough people in the arts. And I think the arts is way more insular at the moment anyway.
Do you find yourself in a situation, I get this sense, and nobody can really understand what you are going through, what the Indian community, and as you say, other communities living in Ireland are going through at the moment, but do you find yourself trying not to stand out almost when you're out and about, just trying to blend in, which is not how it should be, but if you're talking about repeatedly being targeted in this way, do you almost start trying to hide yourself away a little bit?
I do contemplate, like, you know, getting a driver's license because my Indian license is invalid. I live in the city center, so I like walking or cycling, and I think maybe being in a car might be safer because the Indians do that, you know. So I do try to think that maybe I need to maybe not be walking around everywhere.
But isn't it so awful that you even have to think that way?
Yeah, maybe. But then I think there's this, I'm also mindful that maybe the community, like I get a bit awkward that, you know, the Indians can be a bit, like we are all culturally different, and how do we all coexist in our times when, you know, we all find each other a bit, I don't know, annoying.
It sounds like you spend an awful lot of time thinking about this, like to the extent of rather than saying that how terrible it is that this is happening, that you're trying to find an answer from amongst what Indian people are doing, which, you know, it seems unnecessary to think like that.
I hear you.
Seems like a very black and white issue.
Totally, I hear you. Maybe, like, it's definitely crossing a line if one hits someone or makes them bleed if they're annoying.
We don't want to live in a country like that.
Exactly. So then I don't know what the answer is, because I do see Indians being handcuffed and deported from America on planes, and I do see Australians talking about Indians in the workforce, and I don't know. I there are a lot of us, you know, there's a lot of Indians, and there's lots of conflict back home, and life isn't a bed of roses, and people step out to get a better life for their families, and we are a hardworking bunch, you know, and fairly nonviolent and sincere about work, and it's heartbreaking, actually. If you ask me, I speak to my therapist or I cry occasionally, and I'm very concerned for Sirsha when she goes to the creche, and when I'm walking her home, I'm a bit scared. So the other day she said, Baba, let's both wear kurtas. So this traditional Indian...
Oh, that's the long sort of flowing shirt.
Yeah. So she asked me to wear it, and I'd been pushed around the previous evening, and I don't really know how she had this, like, you know, intuition that maybe I needed a bit of push.
So were you even nervous about that, though?
Yeah, I was, because I was walking around where her creche is. You know, sometimes it has a very edgy energy. Some of my friends have been, like, you know, a hit on the street there. So it's all a bit scary. Maybe women have been feeling this all their life, you know. Mm. Anyway, like walking in the dark or walking, being mindful of
how
you are contributing to a conflict. And I think the immigrants might be feeling like... the women.
How did you feel in that moment with Sirsha, though, when she suggested that and the two of you are walking down wearing this traditional Indian dress?
I was pushing her and she was on the scooter, and, you know, I mean, it was a mixture of pride and it was heartbreakingly beautiful. I can probably just think of it as a little scene in a film or a story, you know, where... It is a very tricky time in the world anyway. And I think there's a lot of anger and resentment, and people don't really know who's to blame. And we're looking for scapegoats, and it's easy to think of the outsider as the scapegoat. It's easy to... Yeah.
Are you thinking a lot about this through the prism of having Sirsha now and the country that she's being brought up in and what might face her down the line? Is that a large part of your thought process?
For sure, you know, I don't understand the differences between all of us are a bit cosmetic. It's like just the shade of our skin, the colors, you know, and that seems to be a very juvenile way of differentiating all of us. You know, I don't know what informs that mindset, but it seems to be pretty, you know, rampant in the world at the moment.
How important is it to you that Saoirse keeps wanting to wear her kurta and keeps wanting to engage with the Indian half of her heritage?
I speak with her in Hindi. I make her, I cook a lot, so I cook all the meals and I try to cook a lot of Indian meals and I make her help me. She loves making mean masala milk with me. Mm. So we put cardamom and cloves and turmeric and honey and stuff. And so I try to introduce foods to her. I speak in Hindi with her. And I want her to access the good parts of our religion and culture and spirituality. So there's loads of those lovely things and values that she has from her father's side. And I want her to receive those. And I want her to receive all these lovely parts of being Irish. And I think that would be a pretty deadly mix, you know, for a child to have.
With all this going on, have you had any conversations about moving to India?
It's, again, I have a few issues with... I've grown up in India, right?
Yeah.
And I think we have a few glaring issues there as well. Of course... life would be much easier if I went back. I have a space in Bombay. I have a career and it would be pretty easy. But then there's things that happen there which upset me greatly too, like the class divide. So like everyone's got cooks and help at home and they're not really getting paid adequately. And that upsets me. So I do all the work there myself and... But it's hard to escape the caste and class and race divides, even in India. It seems to be this different aspects of the conflict everywhere at the moment, I think.
And it's very, as you say, it's very hard to have firm answers on, for example, on what's going on in Ireland and what immigrant communities are going through. There was an interesting point made by Kaveri Madhavan, the Indian-Irish author in The Guardian this week. She said the best thing that Irish people... can do is to reach out to the Indian community. She makes the point that Irish people are good at this by nature, chatting and just being sociable. Reach out to the Indian community in small everyday ways, striking up conversation at the bus stop, at the supermarket, that sort of thing. Is that how you see things? Maybe that's one way of improving the situation?
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. Just asking, checking in, you know, like one would with one's friends, how things are. And yeah, that would make people feel a bit... witnessed.
Yeah. Well, Ankur, it's been really moving to hear you speak about those experiences this afternoon. And thank you so much for sharing them with us. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak a little about how sport now fits into the life of the renowned actor and Dublin resident, Ankur Vikal.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
This is the final show of the season of Second Captain Saturday. President Michael D. Higgins merely needs to navigate the next 15 minutes to become our greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson for 2025. What a final honour that would be as his presidency comes to an end. Standing in his way is the actor Ankur Vikal, star of Slumdog Millionaire, among many other films and plays. Ankur, we loved hearing how you ended up here in Ireland, but can you tell us a little about your childhood in India? Where did you grow up?
On the west coast of India is where I grew up, I suppose, in a city called Surat first. I was born in Ahmedabad and I grew up in Surat, which is a small textile hub and diamond hub. So it's like probably one of the richest cities in the world because there's loads of diamonds being cut and polished and textile. And so all the students that I studied with were very privileged and very rich. And I was almost like, you know, between middle class and working class kind of a background. So it was a bit tough being around all these rich dudes in school.
You ended up going to military school, though, later on.
Yeah, I did. Because it was this, like, you know, dream to ride horses and hang, like, maybe as a child one gets fascinated by these things. So,
in a weird, like, post-colonial way, like Tom Brown school days or something, you know? Like,
you're right.
Because I went to a boarding school as well, but I didn't board, but I was... and I had images in my head of whatever, you know, like the sort of English class system allows us to believe boarding school to be like. I'm sure it was... Well, it was more prosaic for me than that. I presume it was also the same for you.
Just very exciting being amidst all these things like guns and horses and stuff. And there's a defense military background on my mom's side.
Okay.
So my uncles, my mom's brothers were in the army. So I went there.
You mentioned the shooting. We hear you were something, and this is where we have to start building up some sporting points here. Okay. Yeah, so we hear you were something of a sharpshooter. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. I was pretty all right with a gun. You know, I found it more fun than being in a classroom. So they would send me off to a firing range with 5,000 bullets, and I'd be just alone in this quiet place as a 12-year-old, you know, with a gun firing things. Fighting at the...
And you got good in a hurry. Like, you were... Yeah, you were very good, were you?
You're right. I mean, because they gave me so much practice and stuff, I kept getting better.
You represented your... So you're being very humble here, Anchor, which I think might be your default mode, but we'll tell you that you represented your state in national competition.
You're
in
right,
Delhi,
yeah.
On... is it Republic Day?
Pardon yeah, my, Republic yeah. Day celebration.
That's the big holiday, yeah. And you're right. In the middle of all this representing your yeah, that's yeah. pretty cool. That's a good
yeah,
moment.
That's pretty,
what are your memories of that?
Not too shabby. It was good fun
that day?
Walking around with a .22 rifle, you know, as a 12-year-old and going on a train to Delhi to fire your rifle. It was good fun, yeah.
In terms of settling into Ireland, has sport been a part of that? Have you gone to any games or anything like that?
Oh, I love Gaelic.
Oh,
Just adore watching Gaelic football matches. And sometimes Trina's dad passes us tickets for the Hill 16 and watch the Dubs play.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you're right in the thick of it there in the middle of Hill 16.
Yeah, it's good fun.
Yeah.
I really enjoy watching.
Good fun once. You know, then after that, I mean, I've experienced it once. That'll do me.
Sure. But watching it on TV as well is a lot of fun. Mm. I do enjoy watching the matches. It's a really interesting sport that I would love to play sometime. I haven't played it yet, but watching hurling and Gaelic football. And, you know, the commercial aspect of it's been completely removed from these sports. And maybe that's what makes them so competitive. I don't know,
no,
in a strange way.
Definitely something about the fact that people are out there competing at an elite level and not getting paid. I mean, that's huge. When you're there, particularly when you're at the matches, what do you like about, as an actor, as somebody involved in that world, do you see the theatre of the whole thing?
Totally, yeah. I also really appreciate the pride that all these counties seem to have. And the amount of backing that each team has, you know, and people traveling all these distances and wearing the colours and showing up at the stadium at Croke Park. And
what colours are you wearing? This is the key. Are you supporting the Dubs? If you're in Hill 16, you must be a Dublin fan.
Sure.
Anchor.
Yeah.
You didn't say that with complete conviction, but I'll take that as a yes. Your own sporting highlight then.
Yes.
If it's not the shooting, what's the highlight of your own sporting career? I believe we're going back to the schoolyard for this one.
Absolutely.
A long way back.
Absolutely, yeah. I was all of five, and I chose to run a marathon in the school with all these high school students. And I remember running with my tiffin box with the spoon ringing inside it because mom used to pack poha for us, which is this lovely rice and potato snack. So I finished it and my spoon was banging in the little tiffin box and I was running the playground.
Oh, okay, so I'm trying to figure out how you're running a marathon in school. You're just going around and around the yard, basically.
Yeah, yeah. There's this maybe 400 meter lap in the school playground. So we were supposed to do 25 of those, or I don't really remember the number. So we were supposed to run around this thing, and my memory, if my memory serves me correct, it always has been a point of contention that maybe I was delusional or maybe I didn't know math, but I did finish. I counted the 25 rounds and I finished them, but I didn't really get acknowledged. Or
why did you not get acknowledged? Surely this little 5-year-old
small,
going around with all
too
the
small
tickets.
To be noticed by the so. Race adjudicators.
I think so, because they were talking about every person who finished the race, because it was a big deal. Not many students, even the high schoolers, finished
15 year olds or whatever.
Yeah.
Did you know that Anchor continued his athletics career after that, Murph? You were known as the master of the three-legged race. You and a friend.
True. Yeah. Yeah, we did. We used to win it each year. Practice every day in the school recess.
Yeah.
We would just have our feet tied and run around. We were just too quick. You know, we were like one organism.
This is it. The confidence is really bursting through now.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a lovely highlight. Anchor, you're our final guest of the season. This is the last chance anyone has to pip President Michael D. Higgins to the top prize. He's number one at the moment. Murph, can you now please rank this sporting life of Anchor Vical?
You don't understand. I could have had class. don't have stars in this game, Mrs. Weaver.
What do you have then?
People like me. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Well, Anchor, we're about to bring the curtain down on another summer spent searching for our greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson of the year. It's had its ups and downs, its highs and lows. But one thing that hasn't changed is the utter bemusement of our esteemed guests as I assess their sporting abilities, pick a sportsperson that I feel most closely resembles them and their sporting achievements, and then, having considered their all-time sporting highlight, give them points out of 100. Your childhood long-distance running is the stuff of sporting prodigies. While your teenage years spent becoming a crack shot from distance remind me, in a very, very real sense, of NBA three-point king Steph Curry. When you're that good, why bother getting any closer than 100 feet? I'm more than happy to add points for your love of the three-legged race, the sport of kings, of course, and for your love of the GA and your eagerness to sample the hill. This is all good stuff. Yep. However, I will have to deduct marks for wanting to go on the hill more than once, which is obviously mental. Do it once, sure, say you can do it, but never again. It's awful up there. I jest, of course.
I hope you do, man.
I jest. Sport is where cultures should meet seamlessly, and my hope is that sport will be somewhere you and others in the Indian community in Dublin and in Ireland can meet on an equal footing in a spirit of inclusivity. I know that's what our season winner, Michael D. Higgins, would dearly love. So I've let the cat out of the bag. You have not scored more than the president's 90 points, but you have scored 79 points, good enough for a top five finish on this summer's leaderboard. And Kurvikal, this has been your sporting life.
I'd happily, like, you know, concede to Mr. Michael D. He's someone I look up to.
Yeah,
as a sporting star.
Yeah, everyone else has to bend the knee to the president. So,
Anger, thank you so much for speaking so brilliantly about all that today, and so openly as well. It's been absolutely marvelous.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Applause, a round of applause, please, for Anchor Vikal, everybody.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure and a privilege being here with all of you. So much fun.
I might have spent 6 months lying on my living room floor.
That's Letting Go by Angie McMahon. She's among the acts performing at Sounds from a Safe Harbour in Cork this weekend, a festival that's well worth checking out. What an incredible way to round out the season, wasn't it, with the remarkable Anchor Vikal. And it's there's so much to that. It's just so shocking and really, more than anything else, desperately sad to hear about some of the stuff that he's gone through. Living in Dublin, he also spoke so well about bringing his daughter up here. I just thought the image of himself and Saoirse walking to creche wearing the traditional Indian clothes was absolutely beautiful.
Yes, like really so emotional.
Poignant. Yeah,
And there's bravery in it, but there's also just like a lovely quiet defiance to it. It was beautiful.
I can only hope the situation improves for the Indian community and others who've come to live in what we like to think is a welcoming country. We contacted An Garda Síochána for comment about the recent attacks on the Indian community in Ireland. This is some of what they said to us. We continue to investigate a number of highly publicised incidents of attacks on injured parties from the Indian community. Each of these individual incidents is being fully and thoroughly investigated under the supervision of a senior investigating officer, which indicate the seriousness to which An Garda Síochána is taking them. Former Garda Commissioner Drew Harris has stated that these attacks are driven by racism and criminality. The investigations will ultimately determine the exact nature and motivations behind each of the incidents, whether that is racism, criminality, both, or something else. The Garda National Diversity Unit is actively engaged with the Federation of Indian Communities in Ireland to address present concerns. Every hate crime reported to An Garda Síochána is professionally investigated and victims supported during the criminal justice process. We want to reassure those of an ethnic or minority background that we are here to keep you safe. A number of prosecutions are currently before the courts related to offences under the Criminal Justice or Hate Offences Act 2024. So that's the end of that statement. And listen, please do get in touch with us, editor@secondcaptains.com, if there's anything you want to add or anything you want to talk to us about. That's the email address to get us at. What a wonderful guest. He was never going to dislodge the president, though, from top spot. Let's be honest. Murph, how does that leaderboard look on the final day of the season?
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Well, bottom on. We'll start at the bottom. 75 points. That's Spider Stacey. I'm sorry, Spider. You are a wonderful guest, a wonderful human being. Just not very good at sport.
Also going first, it's always tough.
It is tough. It is tough. After that, Siobhan McSweeney on 76 points. Joseph O'Connor is next on 78 points, which was the absolute least he could have gotten for those USA 94 diaries alone.
Strong season.
Very strong.
Where was he, did you say? Third from bottom.
I'm afraid he was sixth.
Yeah. Oh my God.
not even top five. Anchor is fifth, as I've just said, on 79 points. Self-Esteem and Brian Ethelburn locked in a Desert Glory battle for third on 83 points. One of our brightest and most talented young poets, two-time national running chap, Alvy Carraher, got a mightily impressive 87 points. But that was not enough to unseat the president, who gets an all-time program high of 90 points. He is our champion of champions.
I was very bad hurler.
Listen, that's a quote taken out of context. 90 points, champion of
champions. What an honour for President Michael D. Higgins. I'm sure he's celebrating in the Oris as we speak.
The champagne corks popped.
That's it from us for now. A gentle reminder, you can catch us anytime you want on secondcaptains.com or wherever you normally get your pods. If you haven't heard our international podcast series Steak Knife, we highly recommend that you give that one a listen as well. This has been a Second Captains production for RTE, produced by Killian Down. Mark Horgan is series producer for Second Captains. Thanks as always to Johnny Lanagan for all her help throughout the season. And a big thanks too to Jack Murphy in RTE. Thank you, Murph.
Thank you very much, Owen.
Most of all, thank you so much for listening. We've had an absolute blast bringing you these shows over the last couple of months. We've loved it, and we will talk to you again soon on RTE Radio 1. Take care, everybody.
Second Captain, First Captain.